Welcome to Art Robot Death, a podcast about art, technology, and society. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter, and with me today is Christian Risto, a pioneer in the field of robotic art. So welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Timothy, for having me here.
Yeah. And so, my goal for this conversation is to start out looking at your journey as an artist. I know there's sort of been a lot of evolution and in how you've approached art with a number of different phases and geographies. And then get to some meta questions about how you look at the interaction between technology and art, and then some of your thoughts on what does it take to be a successful artist and what does that even mean, being a successful artist?
Great.
Yeah, so let's begin with just how did you get involved in the creative act of making art? What was your initial impetus and what kinds of things were you making?
Well, let's see. I mean, it's maybe just a little bit of a cliche, but I was always making stuff. I was a I sort of a maker when I was a kid before the word maker was a thing. When I was a small kid, I was making glue together models, scale models, and I was really into those when I was quite young. And then I discovered that some of them came with motors because they were cars that were designed to go across the floor. And so I'd build that, and then I'd think like, okay, that was cool, but there's a motor in there and it has a switch and some batteries. And if I take that out and I glue it to this other thing, then I can make this other thing happen. And so, for whatever set of reasons that have to do with my natural proclivities and abilities, I was always interested in kinetic stuff from a pretty young age, kinetic and mechanical stuff. Excuse me. And so I would get those motors out and build, a cardboard dinosaur and make his arms move up and down or what have you. And I was always drawing, and I was going to say drawing and painting, but that's not really true. I was always drawing when I was a kid with pencil and markers and whatever. So fast forward to high school. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. During high school, I became aware of this group that was working in San Francisco called Survival Research Laboratories. I was a big fan. I thought what they were doing was incredible and cool. And for whatever reasons embedded in my psychobiography, I was very attracted to that kind of intensity and that kind of like violence and destruction but making that all happen through this medium of machinery and in the within the context of art. That was super exciting to me. Then I went to university and I studied architecture, which was, in the bigger scheme of things, I could argue that it was a little bit of a waste of time. It was a little bit off topic for me. And I came back to San Francisco after university, not really knowing what I wanted to do with myself. And I worked up the courage one day to go visit SRL, Survival Research Labs, these guys who were doing robots as performance art, robot destruction as performance art. It was an immediate fit. Oh, and the other thing I forgot to mention is that while I was at university studying architecture, I actually was, I also learned to weld there when I was in school. And I was at kind of a fancy school where, like, I could have been studying, world economic policy or any number of things. And the thing that I really was into was welding, right? So I took welding every semester, and I was doing sculpture. I was doing mechanical welded sculpture. So when I got back to San Francisco, and like I said, I worked up the courage one day, actually with a buddy of mine. I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I should go over there. Those guys are like too cool for me. And he was like, oh, come on, what do we have to lose? So we went over there, and I introduced myself to the fellow who started the whole thing, who runs SRL, who's a guy called Mark Pauline. And I said, you know, I know how to weld and I've done these mechanical sculptures. I took it really seriously. I brought over pictures of the things I'd done, like it was a job interview or something. And he was like, great, you can weld? Great, weld that. Do that over there. And so within the first hour, I was like working on stuff. And then I actually wasn't intending to move back to the Bay Area. I was just on a short break to come back to the Bay Area, actually for my birthday. Mm-hmm. But I was planning on staying over on the East Coast. But when I started working over there, really on that first day, and then I went the second day, and by the second or third day, I was like, nothing I have going on over back in New York is anywhere cool as this. So I moved back to San Francisco and started working with them. And I worked with SRL for 3 or 4 years pretty consistently and learned a lot. I sometimes think of that as kind of like my graduate school. That was where like my learning curve really went steep, and also in a direction that was very stimulating for me and very inspiring for me. And I learned a hell of a lot about all kinds of things, welding and metal fabrication and hydraulics and mechanical design and electronics and radio control and all this kind of stuff. So I then started building my own robots, kind of very much in the scheme or very analogous to what SRL was doing. And I started using my robots in the context of their shows. And kind of branching out and doing a few of my own little things also in San Francisco. My cat is jumping around my office.
I have a kid running around, so yeah. No reason to feel bad about any of this.
Yeah, I have my kid is doing like a Zoom school thing over in the other room. There was this nagging thing in the back of my head where I was like, I really, really kind of need to like figure out how to make a living. Cause like the architecture thing wasn't really working, or it wasn't stimulating enough for me. I didn't want to follow it. And this thing with SRL was super exciting to me, but it wasn't clear that, you know, how I was going to make a life out of that.
Right.
And, you know, it was an exciting time in the mid-90s in San Francisco, and there was a lot going on. And I had a roommate at the time who had an art gallery. And so I made a sculpture and put it in the art gallery. And another guy who had a thing in the art gallery was Adam Savage. And I met him and I started talking to him. And I was like, well, what do you do to make a living? Do you just like sell this art stuff? And he was like, no, I work in special effects. I was like, wow, that sounds neat. Can I get a job? He said, well, come on over and meet Jamie. So I went over a couple of days later and met Jamie Heineman, and I started working with those guys at M5. And that was kind of it wasn't my first real job. I had done construction and stuff, but it was my first job that had anything really to do with something that was interesting to me.
Right.
And then that evolved into like more than 10 years of my life where I was really doing special effects. And I ended up moving to Los Angeles and doing that in a more focused way, and kind of in a higher, I was working on higher profile projects because the big stuff happens in Los Angeles.
Right.
But I was continuing to build my own robots and kinetic sculpture. And so it was a very multi-pronged kind of career thing that I was doing. I was also doing robot shows that were kind of an extension of what I'd been doing with SRL in San Francisco. I was trying to kind of differentiate myself by making my shows maybe a little bit more narrative and using props that kind of told a little bit more of a story, but then always having the robots destroy the props at the end and destroy each other and stuff like that. And then also doing special effects and puppeteering and all that. And then also kind of doing like smaller kinetic sculptures that I was trying to show in galleries and stuff like that. And so that went well. And that was kind of my trajectory for about a decade living in Los Angeles. A few things kind of happened at the same time, which was the animatronics industry started to slow down because it was it was the time frame when CG was really maturing out of its infancy and becoming a real competitor to animatronics, which had kind of been, you know, for a long time, animatronics had kind of been the king of special effects in terms of like how to get what you wanted on screen. Because CG was around, but it was kind of just didn't look good yet. And then finally CG was really kind of starting to take a big bite and animatronics started to slow down and there was less work. And I had never really loved Los Angeles. mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to leave, but I didn't know where to go and I didn't kind of have a plan. Mm-hmm. And then I met the woman who ended up becoming my wife and she was not from Los Angeles. And one of the first conversations I had with her, or really the first conversation I had with her, was like, "And where do you live?" And she said, "I live in Taos, New Mexico." And I was like, "Where's that?" I had never heard of Taos, New Mexico. And then like fast forward, you know, 10 or 12 months after that conversation, I had left Los Angeles and was living in Taos. And then that kind of started a whole new phase where when I was living in San Francisco, and then certainly through the time that I was living in Los Angeles, I had also been associated in varying ways with the event, which is called Burning Man, which is the big festival,
of course, yes,
in Nevada. Yep. Which is, I mean, we could do a whole podcast about that, but I'll keep it short just by saying that like, it's an awesome event. It's an amazing event, especially from the point of view of what it offers to artists, because it takes place in this ridiculous otherworldly landscape where there are very few restrictions in terms of what you can do and what you can build. You know what, Timothy? I'm sorry, you're going to have to edit this part out, but I am in a room which is...
No problem. If you want to move or...
Yeah.
Take a bio break or anything.
Yeah,
that's the magic of editing.
Okay. Yeah, this room is. I was trying to not bother my son and his Zoom thing. So I went into my office, which has very bad insulation and no heat, and it's like 40 degrees
in
here.
You look freezing. I mean, you're in a full-on winter jacket with a hat.
Yeah, I'm actually too cold to continue. So I'm going to go into this other room here.
And I'm enjoying seeing some of the art in the background. We started off with a beautiful naked woman, and now there's some other images around.
I have, that's kind of my thing. It's like,
yes.
Yes. Anyway, my world is full of that stuff. That's actually what I'm painting these days. But anyway, so let's see here. So I moved to Taos and I had been associated with Burning Man for a long time, but it was mostly what I was doing for Burning Man for quite a few years while I was living in Los Angeles was bringing my robots to Burning Man and staging performances. And that was fun, but it was also kind of like the same thing year after year.
Yeah.
For me. And then, so when I moved out here to Taos, Burning Man is this wide open canvas to do kind of almost whatever you want. And suddenly I was in Taos where I also had a lot of space and it kind of blew my parameters wide open as far as what I could build. And I started building these larger scale interactive mechanical sculptures, primarily for showing at Burning Man. But also during the time that I was in Los Angeles, I also established a relationship with the Coachella Valley Music Festival, because they were also keen on showing these big sculptures. So I started building this big stuff. I started building big mechanical stuff when I moved out here to Taos, that I was showing primarily at Burning Man and Coachella. And then there's this kind of interesting Burning Man and Coachella, because of the scale that they operate on and the kind of budget that they are able to work with, are able to and interested in funding new work. And so that most of the funding that has come for my bigger sculptures has come from those two festivals. But then there's this other interesting thing, which is that a lot of other festivals, even really around the world, want that kind of sculptural bling,
right?
But they don't have the budget to build new stuff, but they have smaller budgets to bring stuff that already exists. So some of the sculptures that I've built have had a really good life moving around the world and being shown at these various other sculptures. I have one in particular called The Hand of Man, which has taken me and my family to Australia and Russia and Israel and Germany and the UK and all over this country, maybe one or two other places that I can't remember. So anyway, talk about long form. I don't even barely remember.
No, that's exactly the territory I wanted to cover. And just before we sort of close out the biographical section of this, you had mentioned in your email to me that you've sort of moved away from that large sculptural and mechanical form. You just mentioned a lot of what you're doing now is sort of painting that has a slightly classical feel to it. So what's sort of taken you away from what you've done sort of in the past into this new form?
Right. So, yeah. So what you're saying is correct. I think it's important to mention that I haven't made some grand decision where I'm like, forget about sculpture. It's been an organic kind of transition, and I don't feel done with sculpture. I don't feel done with mechanical installations or robots or anything like that. Because really that's my first love. And I think I have this gift of being able to visualize mechanical things in three dimensions. And so I get very turned on by the idea of like solving a mechanical problem, or if I come up with an idea of, and it's a sculpture that should move or something that should move, I get very excited by trying to figure out how to make it move. That to me is a very enthralling kind of process to get into. And I don't think I'm walking away from that forever, but a handful of kind of circumstantial events unfolded over the last couple of years. For one thing, okay, so my wife is Swedish, originally Swedish. She grew up kind of all over the world, but, and we've been together for about 16 years. And a couple, 5 or 7 years ago, she started saying like, I'd really like to move back to Europe just for like an experiment, just because I miss it really. And I thought, okay, that sounds great. So we decided on kind of the only place we could agree on was Barcelona. She was like, what about France? I was like, nope, not France. I won't move to France. Cause I have a hard time with the language and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I love like everything German. So I was like, how about Germany? And she was like, nope, not Germany. Cause she had grown up partially in Germany and had some complicated memories around that. But anyway, so the place that we settled on was Barcelona. And so we moved to Barcelona for a year with our boy who was 6 at the time. And, so for the first time in many years, we didn't have access to our fabrication shop, machining, welding, all that stuff. We were living in an apartment. And I did not go to art school, but I've always had an interest in art. So I started kind of treating the time there as like a self-directed art education, because obviously Europe is extremely rich culturally that way. Mm-hmm. And so I started just going to museums all the time, and I ended up buying year passes to museums. And Christina and I went to Venice for the Biennale, which was super duper duper awesome. And I kind of just started getting into more classical art. And my initial focus was very much on sculpture, but I was also kind of starting to notice painting more and more. But anyway, we needed an artistic outlet. Christina and I are both kind of compulsive makers. And and I ended up finding a guy who was a teacher of classical clay figurative sculpture. And so for the second half, more or less, of the time of the year that we were in Barcelona, I was doing figurative clay sculpture, which was great, which was super fun. Turned out I was not bad at it. And I really enjoyed it. And then after a year, this is more of a side note, but after a year of being there, it was time to go back. We had thought like that we were only going to be there for a year, and we had only organized renters of our house for 1 year, and we had dogs to come back to and all this stuff. But we were thinking like, this experiment kind of feels like it's not over yet. We kind of want to stay, but Barcelona is not really a great fit for us. We had a hard time finding a school for our boy. And we had a really hard time finding anything that we would call a maker space. We were really looking for a place where we could go, a place that kind of already had some tools and a bit of a community where we could jump in and get creative. And that idea hadn't really caught on in Barcelona yet. So we wanted a change. So we actually settled on Berlin for the second year that we were there. Christina made an exception to her Never Germany rule, and we went to Berlin. We went to Berlin for the second year. We ended up, so the whole makerspace concept was more, had already taken root in Berlin, and it was quite easy for us to find some places to work. We found some pretty neat places to work and some great community. We made some good friends, and I ended up getting a grant or a commission to build something new for Burning Man while we were in Berlin. So, I found this incredible resource, which, I mean, it would be so amazing if this kind of thing was more common than it is. But in any case, the city of Berlin subsidizes a gigantic workshop, which is only for sculptors. And it's in a former safe factory. It's hard for me to estimate how many square feet it is, but it's probably 20,000 square feet or more. It's got overhead cranes and machine tools and welding facilities and metal fabrication. It's really incredible. And then there's one section for ceramic, and then there's one section for wood. And I was in the metal section. I built a sculpture for Burning Man while we were in Berlin, which was a sculpture called "With Open Arms, We Welcomed That Which Would Destroy Us," which is actually the theme in 2019, the theme for Burning Man in 2019 was robots. It was kind of like, it was pretty wide open. It was actually, I think it was called iRobot, the theme. And so obviously I had built a lot of robots in the past, but I wanted to do something more interesting and, or different anyway. And so I kind of started just doing a bit of a deep dive in terms of reading about what was going on with robotic technology these days. And that very quickly led me to AI. And that very quickly led me to a lot of sort of dystopian projections for how things could go wrong, kind of Isaac Asimov type of narratives. And that was very interesting to me. And then I, without realizing it, this was not intentional, but I can see it now in retrospect. I also brought in this new interest that I had developed in figurative sculpture. And I came up with this proposal, which Burning Man ended up liking enough to fund, which was basically a robot god. It was kind of a projected dystopian future about a scenario in which humanity has kind of fallen in love with technology and fallen in love with AI to the degree that we were blind to some of the possible pitfalls and didn't put in.
Is this the future or the present?
The future.
Because this,
It's a scenario. It's a near future scenario. You know, a theoretical right. scenario. I mean, yeah, that's a ironic question. But anyway, a near future scenario in which we had not put in enough safeguards to control the development of AI and so forth. And the theoretical, the narrative that underpins the sculpture is that, at some point robots kind of take over and they realize that that the only thing holding them back from complete takeover is the pesky humans, because there's some humans that are kind of like not into this idea of the new robot overlords. And the, so the last thing they do to solidify or consolidate their control over us is they kind of look back through our history and they're like, humans over the course of history seem to be really interested in this idea of a deity and really willing to subjugate themselves to a deity. So they build, so the robots build one of their own as a god. And they compel the remaining human population to, you know, subjugate themselves to this god. So the sculpture is of the robot god. And I was also really into like Hindu and Hindu and Buddhist sculpture at the time. So it's this, so the sculpture, what the sculpture is this giant pedestal. And around the pedestal is a, like a frieze, like a low relief sculptural frieze, like you see on the Parthenon, for instance. Mm-hmm. And the frieze tells the story. We designed these kind of cartoonish narrative panels and had them CNC milled out of aluminum. And then I rolled the aluminum into curves. And so it's this frieze that tells the story basically of how we built this cute little robot in the beginning, and it's really small and the humans are big and we're able to dominate it and so forth. And then the robot morphs into something that's dominating us. And by the end, the humans are just kind of beggars at the feet of the robot and its total domination. And then on top of this pedestal is the god, and it's I fabricated it all out of aluminum, which was fun and challenging. And it's basically a god that's sitting in this kind of asymmetric position. It's not lotus position, but it's a position that's very reminiscent of like, of Buddha sculpture, for instance. But the robot is actually two-sided. So there's a face on one side and a face and another face on the backside. There's four arms and four legs. So either side, you're looking at the front of the robot, and the robot has and one face is like benevolent and calm, and the other is kind of voracious and malicious. And that to me was like, I was trying to get into this metaphor of our relationship with technology, and that technology does not necessarily always have our best interest at heart. I also tried to make the robot kind of like beautiful and kind of like sexy in a way, because that's what technology is. It's like, it's slick, it's beautiful, it promises this and connectedness and efficiency and all this shit. So, or and all this stuff. So, and so
you can curse on this podcast.
Fine. So it draws us in, right? That's what I want. I wanted the sculpture from a distance to be like, oh, that's cool and it's beautiful and it's shiny and I want to get closer to that, which is kind of how technology works, right? It's alluring and it brings us in. But then the closer you get to it, and especially when you start to read the frieze and when you start to see the expression on the face of the one side, it's like, oh, wait, hold on a second. Is this something that I should be afraid of? So anyway, I was trying to play with all those metaphors. So I built that sculpture while we were in Berlin, shipped it over to the States, which was a colossal nightmare, like much more than a nightmare than I thought it would be, because I've actually done a lot of international shipping, and for some reason, this one was just 10 times worse. And so let's see. So that was exciting, but I'm trying to now get back to your original question, which was this transition. So Europe, so it had a lot to do with Europe and getting interested in the more classical figurative type of work. And then what happened was basically after we got back to the States, after our second year over there, the year in Berlin, there were a few things going on. I put together a proposal for Burning. So Coachella stopped funding new work. So Burning Man was kind of like the big avenue. I put together a proposal for Burning Man in 2000 for the 2019 year. I'm sorry, I misspoke earlier. The robot god that I built was actually for Burning Man 2018.
Okay.
So I put together a proposal for 2019, and it was rejected. And being a sensitive artist and a normal human, I took that rejection kind of hard. I thought it was a really good proposal. I was quite excited about it. It was rejected. And that kind of opened up this thing inside me where I realized that I was quite frustrated with what I felt like were limited avenues for securing funding for these kinds of things that I wanted to build. And meanwhile, I was there was also this growing thing in the back of my mind, which was like, I feel like I need to paint. I feel like I need to, there are other things that are going on with me mm-hmm. in terms of my psychology and my just like my artistic development. There are things that I want to paint. There are images that I have in my head that I want to bring into the world. And my initial reaction to this was like, well, I'm not a painter. I don't know how to paint. I can't do that. That's not what I do. So I started trying to imagine how I could bring these things into fruition sculpturally. Mm-hmm. But as I thought about it, I was just like, yeah, you know, I'm really forcing it. Like these are images. And so I kind of just, something just snapped where I was like, you know what? I just need to start to learn how to paint. And it was intimidating at first because I've never really worked too much in 2D. But thank God we live in the like age of YouTube. I just started like going to the library and picking up books and watching a lot of YouTube videos about how to paint and started teaching myself. The other thing that is maybe worth mentioning just for a second is that part of what pushed me in that direction, which I alluded to just, you know, 2 or 3 minutes ago, is that there are, I believe that at this point in like the evolution of my understanding of myself and my own mm-hmm. psychology, there are things that are coming to the surface about the way that I understand myself and my upbringing and why I am the way I am and how I've become the person that I am, that I want to give those narratives a voice and I want to make them into art. And they are better suited to images than they are to sculptures, and certainly they're better suited to images than they are to like big mechanical sculptures. Now, so it's a very fruitful avenue for me right now to be painting and making images. Now that being said, it's also true that I feel like there might be another artistic phase in my future, which might look something more like a synthesis of mm-hmm. these different strains. Because like I said, like I love designing mechanical stuff. I'm a really good metal fabricator. I can do things quickly and make them come out right. And I like that kind of work. But I feel like there are these things that I'm trying to express that are more suited to images. And there may be a synthesis at some point in the future where I realize or I hit upon some way to bring these narratives, which to me are more personal and meaningful, and actualize them through sculptural means and possibly even like kinetic metal fabrication oriented types of avenues.
Great, that makes a lot of sense. And so now I want to turn to sort of to some of the themes that have been raised in your biography, you know, starting with how do you think about the balance or relationship between technology and art in what you're creating?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question for me to try to answer right now, because I, in a way, have my artistic output and the means by which I'm mm-hmm. expressing myself artistically have devolved, right? Like I've gone back to like painting and sculpture, mm-hmm. whereas 10, 15 years ago, I was very much into technology as a means of expression. So it's, like I said, it's an interesting question for me to answer at this time. I think technology is another tool in the toolbox as far mm-hmm. as artistic expression. And there are, It has its strengths, and I think its strengths in to some degree are what I'm trying to say is people understand technology now. People relate to technology Mm-hmm. People spend so much time in front of the computer. People are doing, you know, a lot of people are doing video games and VR environments and all this stuff. And so technology is, which is of course a very broad term. I'll just leave it at that for now, is able to communicate to people in these new ways that they are already accustomed to and are understanding, and present content in these new ways, which can be, I think, very, engaging because people are living more and more in that world. And certainly COVID has like ramped that up a lot. People are spending a lot of time in front of their computers. I guess video games are kind of going wild too. I've never been too into video games, but I guess their popularity is soaring. You can also, the type of content, or really, I guess what the richness and amount of content that you can impart through technology, is really a different order of magnitude than sculpture and painting. Sculpture and painting are both like static experiences. Sculpture is a little bit less so because you can walk around it and you can get it from different points of view. And certainly if we start branching into the idea of kinetic sculpture, that's not a static experience, but that's also technology. We're also getting into an art medium that can express a lot more than a static image. One of the things that I think about and have talked about and have blogged about is how powerful film is in terms of expressing content and conveying emotion and narrative and all that stuff. And I mean, if you want to in one sense, and it's a little bit, maybe even it has an old fashioned feel at this point in the development of technology and humanity, but really film is technology. Film was cutting edge stuff, 60, 70 years ago, whatever. And it was able to present a cultural or artistic experience in a tremendously richer way than traditional artistic media had done in the past. And, one thing that I've said and thought before is like a painting, for instance, is like one, it's like a photograph where it's like a snapshot. It's like one thing. It's one moment in time. And it can convey one, or if you're lucky, two or three or four things in terms of emotion and narrative and stuff like that. But film is transmitting that stuff all the time. One scene to the next, to the next, to the next. It's this whole roller coaster ride of images and experiences and emotional manipulation. That's a harsh word, but films can take you on a journey in a way that regular media can't. And one thing that occurs to me as a way of also looking into this question that you're asking is a couple of years ago, like I mentioned, we were able to visit the Venice Biennale, which is this, every other year, it's kind of like the, I don't know what you want to call it. It's the Super Bowl of art.
Sure.
There was a lot of great stuff there, and a lot of it was very traditional, but there was also a lot of very cutting edge stuff that was, a lot of it was focused around video, but then I also had the opportunity to do a couple of these VR installations, which were done by artists. One was done by Björk, the famous Icelandic musician who I happen to love as a musician. But anyway, she had done this VR installation where you put on goggles and you're moving through this space, and it was basically centered around her, an image of her that kind of morphed and transmogrified into different permutations, and it was a super super otherworldly landscape. And it was, and then there was another one by another VR installation by a guy called Paul McCarthy, who's an artist who's a pretty edgy, provocative artist who I happen to like a lot also. And that one was super weird. That one was like super weird, based on like a Old West theme. And it was like people moving in and out of each other. And it ended up being quite violent and provocative. But, you know, this, so just, and those experiences were intense. They were immersive, and they were like film in the sense that they were a roller coaster ride of images and emotions, but they were pushing past it, both in terms of your physical and corporeal experience, because one of the things with VR is you can move around and you can turn and mm-hmm. you can see different things. You're kind of the agent of your own experience to a degree. And also in terms of, I don't know, in terms of the freedom that those artists felt in terms of narrative and what they were really presenting. So it was a brand new experience. Like, it was something I hadn't experienced before.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that's, what is the job of art, right? That's an old question, but one of the jobs of art is to push people's boundaries, to push people's expectations, and to offer something new that's thought-provoking. And those VR experiences, to me, stand out very strongly in my mind as something as technologically mediated experiences, which very much fulfilled those roles for me in terms of pushing my experience and presenting something new that was thought-provoking that I still haven't stopped thinking about several years later.
And that brings me to my next question. And I think, you know, this is actually well-timed. You sort of said you've temporarily moved a bit away from sort of technologically enabled art creation, but that you can imagine coming back to it.
Yeah.
And I guess, what do you think has changed in what you're able to do, right? What, you know, if you really start diving back into that next year, what do you think would be available to you that maybe wasn't available to you 10 years ago?
Well, I find myself second guessing. I find myself trying to read between the lines of what you're asking, and I'll answer it in a couple different ways, all of which are true. if you're getting at how has the technology advanced in the interim? I would say that I don't really know, but I have faith that it has.
Sure.
In terms of like what I was just talking about, in terms of like, choreographing a VR type experience, or using the internet to remotely control devices or whatever, the technology doesn't stop advancing. And I'm sure that every day there's new stuff that an artist or somebody with that kind of inclination can take advantage of. One of the things that I kind of have come to understand about myself, but also just about like artistic practice in general, is that at a certain point, it is more efficient and more advantageous to tap the talents of other people mm-hmm. who have expertise in other fields that you want to take advantage of, rather than try to learn it all and do it all yourself. Mm-hmm. And I'm unfortunately one of those people who tries to learn it all and do it all myself. And what that ends up being, functionally speaking, is a limitation. Mm-hmm. Because you can't do it all and learn it all. You can't learn it all and do everything on your own. You know, life is too short, and you end up not spending enough time doing the things that you want to do or that you're good at. So that's one of the lessons that I have learned and need to keep learning. And what I'm saying what I'm saying in terms of how it applies to me more personally is that if and when I do get back to building mechanical and kinetic and interactive type of sculptural installation work, if there are technologies that I want to take advantage of that I feel would enhance the experience or bring the piece to life in a way that I think I want to do, that it it would behoove me. I need to reach out and work with people who can do that kind of thing. But the other way to answer your question, as far as what I will be able to bring to that kind of synthesis or new phase, and the way to answer that question, which I think is actually a little bit more meaningful and on topic for me, is that I think that I will be able to bring a narrative that is more personal and more meaningful than some of the work that I had done before. You know, one of the axioms that I believe in and subscribe to when it comes to artistic production is that the really deeply individual is the really truly universal. And what I mean by that is I think that when an artist is able to go really deeply, to go to a place that's really deeply personal in terms of their own narrative, their own biography, their own struggle, their own whatever it is that's deep inside them that feels relevant and that needs to come out into the world through their artistic practice, that's when it becomes really deep and personal like that, that is when other people start to actually see themselves in it, and when other people start to actually have a meaningful experience with their work. You know, I think that the opposite of that is that when people are kind of, instead of being deeply personal, when people are trying to make a work of art that they are guessing or wanting to be accessible or meaningful or whatever, the work ends up being, in my opinion, and I don't think I'm the only one that holds this opinion, more superficial and less deep and consequently less meaningful to the people for whom it resonates. So if and when I bring like a metal fabrication and kinetic and interactive type of layer back into my art practice, I think the subject matter will have changed and will be, and the subject matter will be a synthesis of these technical abilities that I did pretty well in terms of like perfecting and and growing with in my 20s, 30s, and early 40s, with a new trajectory in terms of subject matter, which I believe and hope will be different and possibly more resonant and meaningful than what I'd done in the past.
That's really a beautiful idea. And so just what would you say is the state of robotic art right now? I feel like it's sort of, you know, SRL was pretty seminal, but now it doesn't feel to me like it has as much of a locus, but that may be my own ignorance. So I'd love to hear sort of how you feel that field of interactive, technologically enabled, but, you know, more on the art side of the art commerce equation, where is that right now?
So to a certain degree, I live under a rock. You know, COVID has certainly brought me into closer communion with the fact that I am kind of an introvert and I'm kind of okay living under a rock. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a kid that takes a lot of time. When I have some free time, I go paint. I guess I'm trying to build up a caveat for myself in terms of saying that I'm not particularly engaged with what is probably the cutting edge right now in terms of the intersection of technology and art. I love SRL and SRL has been a really meaningful influence in my life. And certainly it spoke very strongly and very provocatively to me as a younger person in terms of like that kind of violence and that kind of like power and control mean, that's a whole other avenue I could go off on about power and control. I'm getting a little bit all over the place here, but like, I mean, I think that's one of the really powerful things that technology can offer people in terms of an artistic experience, is this feeling of agency and this feeling of like, of being in control. And that was an undercurrent or a psychological need that I was, I think, very much tapping into with the sculpture that I mentioned earlier, which was called The Hand of Man, mm-hmm. which is this sculpture, which is a giant metal, like hydraulically actuated steel robotic right hand and forearm, which is big enough and capable of picking up and crushing cars, which is mm-hmm. controlled by a
awesome
telemetry glove that I made. Which I run at festivals, and I let anyone who wants to control this glove and pick up and smash cars for a while. And that part of the reason I think that sculpture was successful is because it taps into this this need that people have to feel in control of their environment. This could get very esoteric and philosophical, but I'll keep it short by saying that in this world, I think people don't get that feeling of power and control enough. Mm-hmm. I think people move through life often feeling like they're at the whim of circumstances beyond their control, and they're kind of being pushed around by life, and they don't have enough agency. And certainly, there's a psychology element to that, and there's a degree to which people can make certain basic decisions and changes in their own mind that can really lead to a more positive outcome. But blah, 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 this isn't about Buddhism. This is about technology and art. So The Hand of Man offered that. It's part of why it's successful. I think SRL offers that also in a different way. It's more of a display of that, which people can experience vicariously. In the sense that it's thrilling and exciting just to see very forceful and intentional interactions between technology, between robots or between robots and other kinds of technology. And I think that kind of, there's also a thrill seeking aspect to it in terms of, I think, why SRL is successful. People like to watch, you know, videos of car chases, and people like to watch videos of controlled demolition of buildings and stuff like that. And SRL is tapping into that, which I think is very primal. But there's more to technology than just that. And technology, as we've said, is, you know, advances very rapidly. And so as far as like where technology and art intersect these days, I mean, I think that it is mutating and permutating quickly, and it as a tool, one of the things I said earlier is it's another tool in the toolbox. And I think as a tool, technology is something like, there are 300 million people on the earth, or billion, or 60 billion, I can't remember the numbers. But anyway, if 5% of those are artists, that's a hell of a lot of artists. And yeah, that's a lot of individual visions. And some percentage of those people are going to take advantage of technology in terms of like robotics, VR, telemetry controlled type stuff to actualize their visions. One of the pieces that sticks in my mind, which I feel like is closer to the cutting edge, but unfortunately I'm not going to be able to remember the name of the piece or the artist. But it was this robotic, or I believe they were using the word animatronic when, in terms of this particular installation, a woman who was standing facing a mirror, and she was connected to the mirror by a single pole kind of coming out of her belly button area that went into the mirrored wall. I can only imagine that the power supply was coming through that pole in addition to mechanically holding her up. Is it ringing a bell? Do you remember the piece I'm talking about?
I think I have heard about this, although I don't know the name of the person or the art piece. But I remember seeing it.
Seeing it
on the web or something. Yeah.
Yeah. There was an interesting profile of the artist in the New Yorker a couple months ago. But anyway, the piece was sexy, alluring, unsettling, disturbing, all those things at once, because the animatronic figure had the shape of an attractive woman, and yet it was wearing a mask and had, which was very like fucked up looking and kind of disturbing, and the part of her face that was coming down below was also kind of disfigured, if I remember correctly, and she was like doing this gyrational dance kind of for herself because she was looking at the mirror. So the whole thing of like dancing with yourself, looking at the mirror, a very kind of solipsistic kind of experience that I think taps in a little bit or reflects a little bit this kind of fucked up relationship that we all have with our phones and with social media, where we're always staring at the damn thing. And half the time when you're on a Zoom call or a FaceTime or whatever, you're actually just looking at yourself up in the upper corner, like, do I look good? How is this going? Do I need to do this? So there was that, but then there was also the technologically mediated or facilitated fact that this was a very sophisticated robotic character, which was presumably programmable and controllable in terms of what she was doing, and was doing dances that were like disturbing, that were like unsettling. So, you know, that's an example of a very kind of high level of technology being used as a tool to articulate a very idiosyncratic vision on the part of the artist. And so, you know, I have to speak in general terms because, like I said, I'm not like tapped in right now. I'm just more really interested in painting at the moment. But in general terms, technology is a toolbox. Technology is a tool in the toolbox. It's very powerful because it's very broad and it's very, and it's expanding constantly and advancing constantly. And there are a lot of people out there who are experts, right? Who are like, their focus is learning the next new thing. And so an artist who is bold enough and committed enough to their vision can access these resources, find these people and say, hey, I've got this vision. You might think it's weird, but I don't care because it's my vision. And this is what I want it to be. And I want you to help me. And so let's do this thing. And so technology then becomes this very powerful tool in the toolbox. It's something that the things that will come out of artist studios this year are things that couldn't have been made last year. And the things that were made last year couldn't have been made the year before. And so what we're seeing these days in the art world technologically, at least as far as the upper end of the people who are really taking advantage of that stuff, is stuff that was not even imaginable 10, 15 years ago. And that's just going to continue to advance. So, you know, as far as whether or not that's valuable, like that's another question. And I think that when technology is understood as a tool to articulate a vision, then it's valuable because if the vision is interesting, if it's universal, if it's something that reaches people, and the technology works as a facilitator to make that message come across, then great. That's awesome. That's exactly the right relationship between art and technology. If it's something where the artist is just so enamored with the technology that it's just kind of a virtuoso display of the coolest new thing, but after you get under that and you say, well, what is the content of this? If there's not really any content there, then that's not something that is going to touch a lot of people, and I don't think it's something that's going to last. So, you know, it's always about the vision and the content and the narrative and whether or not the piece is actually saying something. And then if you've got that and you've got a piece or a layer of technology that's bringing that to the people in a way that it couldn't be brought to people 5 years ago, that's what it should be.
That's very eloquently put. Just a few more questions, going in a slightly different direction and looking at the commerce side of it. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you think is the difference between those who are financially successful as artists and those that are not? There's a lot of talent out there and there's a lot of starving artists. So
yeah,
how do people get to not be starving?
Do you need me to restate your question in my answer?
Sure. That could be helpful.
Okay. It's kind of like a...
What's the question that you understand me to have said, and then what's the answer to your interpretation of that question?
Sure. Yeah. So, what I hear you asking is sort of who makes the cut as an artist in terms of reaching financial success or viability? What are the factors that can differentiate the starving artist from the person who's making a living? I'm tempted to say I have no idea, because on a certain level I don't, but I do have more to say on it than that. Mm-hmm. I also don't know which category I'm in at this point. Mm-hmm. There's a part of the way that I would like to answer that question, and one of my thoughts on this topic, which might be a little idealistic, although I think it's part of the equation, is that I think it really does depend on the artist's ability or willingness to articulate a unique viewpoint. Mm-hmm. I think that it comes down to, on some level, financial or at least critical success depends on the courage of the artist to say something that is truly personal, mm-hmm. In whatever way they're going to do that. Because if you're not, look, there's a gazillion. My son asked me the other day if that was a real number. There's a very high number of people who know who are technically proficient at their craft. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm learning how to paint. I'm sort of okay. And I think for somebody who's only done 5 paintings, I'm actually pretty flippin' good. But there are so many people out there who are better painters than I am. But to just have command of your technique and to command of your craft is not enough. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to say something. You have to be willing to say something that's either deeply personal. And I know I've actually sort of only focused on the quote unquote deeply personal, because to me, that's actually the more compelling field or area in which an artist can work, but that's not the only one. You can also, an artist can also work in basically like the social realm, basically like making social commentary, mm-hmm. Writing, drawing, painting, sculpting about what's wrong with the world. And that's a very rich vein to tap, mm-hmm. and equally valid. It's actually not my preferred type of art, but I think it is actually equally valid. But the point is that you have to be willing to say something that is unique and bold and daring, so that it provokes people, so that it catches people's attention and makes people think and makes people take a second guess or a second thought about something. because a person who is a master of their craft but not saying anything interesting is going to only reach a limited audience. So that's part of it. I believe that's part of it. In this day and age, I think you could certainly make an argument that another important part of it, I don't know if it's equally important, it may well be, another very important part of it is self-promotion, social media. You can, you know, the most talented artist in the world who's saying the most compelling, most personal, most provocative shit isn't going to go anywhere if the paintings never leave the studio and no one ever sees them or whatever. You know, you right. have to get the work out there. I think that being savvy with the internet and with social media and with self-promotion in general is important. You know, unfortunately, a lot of artists are not particularly gifted in that realm, and they'd rather just work. The advice I would give to those people is like, work with somebody, find somebody to help you get your stuff out there, get your stuff in front of eyes. And, you know, I'm sure there's also a big role to be played in terms of like reaching financial or critical success. I'm sure there's a big role to be played by, networking, connections, mm-hmm. meeting people, knowing the right people, being willing to like go and have conversations with gallerists and collectors and say, and pimp yourself a little bit. It's related to the second topic, which is self-promotion. But again, it's like, and to some degree, I feel like I have sort of inadvertently listed these factors in descending importance, or what I believe is in descending importance. I really do believe that the work has to be strong and powerful, and it has to say something. Because if you're not strong in that department, but you're really good at self-promoting, you will get somewhere, but it'll peter out. You know, I don't think it's, I think you need to be making something valuable and important and personal that says something. And then you need to figure out how to get that work in front of eyes. And then, you know, I don't know. I think there's probably a luck factor. You know, I think there's probably, you know, hitting a lucky break, being in the right gallery at the right time and striking up the right conversation yeah. with the right collector or whatever. But, you know, people make their own luck, right? I mean, you're not going to have that conversation if you're not at the opening. You're not going to be able to pimp this great work that you just did if you didn't actually just do the great work. So you have to yeah. you have to do it. You have to do the work, and then you have to put yourself in the right places, and you have to talk to the people. And so it's a slog, you know, it's just like anyone trying to break out or make it in almost anything. Yeah. You have to be dedicated to what you're doing, and then you have to be willing to just kind of sell yourself a little.
Thank you, Christian, for joining us for the first episode of Art Robot Death. And thanks to all of you who listened. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to this podcast, leave a review, tell your friends, and we hope to have a new episode every week. Thank you. Bye.